Are you ready to get charged up? Because I am. Hey there, everybody. Welcome to episode number 530 of this here electronic engineering podcast called Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by eejournal.com and written, produced, and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. We are talking about battery technology today. My guest is James Wilcox from Enovix, and we're talking all about how Enovix is disrupting the battery industry. We're also chatting about the details of Enovix's brake flow technology and what sets their battery technology away from the rest of the pack. Also, a little later on, I investigate the world's first transistor made of wood. Yep, wood. You'll want to stick around for that. But first, please welcome James to Fish Fry. Hi, James. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Amelia. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Okay, so we're talking about how Enovix is disrupting the lithium-ion battery industry today. But James, before we dig into the details of your technology, can you set the stage for us? What are the biggest challenges you're seeing in this industry today?
Absolutely. The consumer market, because that's where our focus largely is today. But obviously, a lot of the same issues are in the EV space as well, which is actually where I'm leading our EV team currently. But in the consumer space, one of the big things we're seeing today is that the devices that we have, the cell phones, smartwatches, IoT, are really being limited by the energy that they can store in their battery. I mean, the industry has seen just massive improvements in processing power, memory, storage, you know, connectivity, displays over the last 20 years. I mean, 10 to 40% annualized basis, you know, growth. But batteries have been growing at 4% per year. And so clearly they're not keeping up. The rate of development's not keeping up. And we need to do better. And so that's really where the issue is today. And I think historically, you know, people have really looked at improving energy density in batteries by improving materials, and which is a great way to go. I'm a material scientist, so I highly support that. But the other issue is eventually that kind of runs out and we're kind of limiting it at the amount of material we can get or what we can get out of our materials today. And that's where we come in. I think we're taking a look at how else can we not only work on the materials, but also enable next generation architectures. So essentially, like we said, batteries have been improving about 4% per year, largely through improvements with materials in conjunction with kind of decreasing the amount of inactive materials in the cell, whether it be current collectors or separators and just marginal manufacturing improvements. But really, you know, that roadmap is kind of running out. And now you're seeing the industry talk about things are what's coming next. And this is where you see people talk about silicon anodes, for example, solid state or lithium metal, which are all great from a material standpoint. They have a lot of potential, but they all offer a lot of issues when it comes to actually building a functional cell and incorporating that into a device. For example, silicon, which is what we work on today, has a great ability to store lithium. It stores about twice as much lithium as graphite per unit volume. But it swells 200, 300% during operation and has a very poor first cycle efficiency. So building a functional cell out of that is very difficult. And our solution to that is to not only look at the materials, but to look at the cell architecture as a way to work together to enable these next generation materials.
So James, what sets your battery technology away from the rest of the pack? And how can it help solve the issues you mentioned?
We were founded in 2007, but we've been founded with the idea of kind of how to build a better battery and unlock the potential of these materials. And I should start by saying that our battery architecture is 100% material agnostic, meaning I'll talk about silicon today, but we can really use any advanced cathode or anode material that's out there. The architecture doesn't depend on any single material, which is great. Today, for example, we use 100% active silicon anode in our cells that allows us to achieve a very high volumetric energy density, up to double what can be done in the industry today. But we can really go into any other material we want in the future. But one of the key things that we've figured out over these years is that if you want to be able to use 100% silicon anode battery, for example, one of the best ways to do that is by putting a large amount of stack pressure on the electrodes. What we found out is if you can put about 10 megapascals of pressure on the electrodes, you can actually significantly improve the silicon cycle life and performance. That's great, except for the fact that 10 megapascals is a lot of pressure. And just to put that in context, if you put that on a pressure onto a small cell phone battery, for example, a 30 by 50 millimeter cell phone battery, you're talking about having to apply about 1.7 tons of force to be able to achieve that pressure. And if you want to put that into your cell phone, it's not a practical device anymore. Nobody's going to be carrying that around. So what we've done is we looked at the battery a little bit differently. So we stack our electrodes orthogonally. So instead of stacking large sheets of electrode, we stack smaller electrodes that are now aligned to a smaller face of the battery. What's really beneficial about that is we still need to put that same 10 megapascals worth of pressure on the cell, but because we're acting on a much smaller area, now the force required to develop that high pressure is much lower. And so now we're going for that 1.7 tons approximately, down to something like 200 pounds. And 200 pounds is something that can be achieved pretty readily by, you know, thin stainless steel sheets, if you put them in tension, which is what we do. We put a constraint around our electrode stack. And we're talking about sheets that are 50 to 75 microns thick. So now you're talking about a mechanical constraint system that is not only volumetrically, but gravimetrically efficient. And now it can be put into a consumer device pretty efficiently. And you can unlock that full potential of silicon, which is great. The other things we can do, you know, like I said, by stacking orthogonally, we can now do what's called pre-lithiation. We can now add extra lithium back into the cell. And I mentioned before that, you know, for example, silicon has a poor first cycle efficiency. And what that really means is if you put too much silicon into the cell, you lose too much lithium on your first charge and discharge that your capacity of your battery actually goes down. But by being able to add this lithium back into the cell very efficiently because of the stacking structure, we can now fully utilize the anode and therefore the cathode as well and get the most energy out of the system. And so benefits that we have, like really, obviously, energy density is a big one. We announced at CES in January that we showed our next generation platform, which is EX1.5, which had an energy density of over 1,000 watt-hours per liter when you scale it to a cell phone-sized cell, which is great. That additional pressure that we put on the electrode stack really helps stabilize the electrode and therefore stabilize the material performance, which can really enable higher calendar life and cycle life. And we demonstrated that recently as part of a DOE-funded development project where we achieved over 10-year projected calendar life and over 1,500 cycles. And also, we can take advantage of the pure silicon anode, meaning now, you know, silicon is known to have a very high charge rate capability. It lithiates at a much higher potential than graphite, meaning you can kind of get that lithium there a lot faster before you worry about things like lithium plating. And so we can really take advantage of that and achieve very high charge rates. And then we can build onto the safety on top of that. And so you put all these together, and you know, we've obviously put a real package together, and we have strong demand from the consumer space, most of the major consumer electronics manufacturers in the world, including Samsung. And as we do that, and right now, like I said, we're taking that into production here in Fremont, and we just announced into Malaysia next year, or late this year, early next year, and then onto EVs in the future.
Fantastic. Now, James, I was also really interested in your brake flow technology. So can you talk to my audience a bit about that?
Sure. Well, before we talk about brake flow, maybe the right way to start is to start talking about kind of abuse tolerance and internal short circuits and batteries more generally. Batteries, you know, everybody's seen the videos on the internet when you see a battery going to thermal runaway, it's very catastrophic. And really, those are generally being developed by internal short circuits, which is you get a defect that allows an electrode pair, an anode and a cathode to make connection. And now the battery can start to discharge through that short without going through the rest of the system. And the problem with doing that is you can develop very high current densities going through that short, which gives you a lot of heating. And if the heating gets high enough, now you can start to evolve oxygen from the cathode material. And now you have heat, you have oxygen, you have a hydrocarbon and the electrolytes and everything. So you have a perfect, you know, kind of storm for a catastrophic thermal runaway. So we want to avoid that. And there's kind of two ways we think about it. One is just from an architectural standpoint, we really try to think about what are ways we can improve our abuse tolerance to things that generate shorts. So for example, like I said, we put a mechanical constraint around our electrode stack. That really can help us kind of absorb, you know, kind of some of those environmental impacts, like we put the battery under crush or something like that. It actually holds up better than a traditional pouch cell. And actually, our goal is to help prevent the formation of the internal short. Brake flow is intended that if you do in the event where you get internal short, an internal short could be caused by many things. It could be caused by manufacturing defects. It could be caused by, like I said, the environmental use, whether I'm crushing it, I'm puncturing it, I'm stabbing it, or just by abusing the way you use the cell. You could overcharge the cell. And so brake flow really comes in the event that you do have a internal short circuit. The idea is it gives you this extra layer of protection, allows you to hopefully dissipate the power of that short much more carefully, much more or longer period of time, and prevent the heat from getting into that high temperature range. And the way it works is kind of twofold. One is we take advantage of the fact that because we're stacking a larger number of smaller electrodes, there isn't really enough energy in any single electrode pair to cause thermal runaway on its own. So we have that kind of subunit level protection. And then each one of these electrodes is connected to a common bus bar. And on that bus bar, we can put a kind of resistive element, the brake flow element, that under normal operation is fairly transparent. It's not resistive enough to change how the battery performs under your daily use conditions. But in the event of an internal short, you know, now that all the energy from the cell wants to start to dissipate through that one set of that one defect, that one electrode pair, and the cell starts to heat up, now that brake flow can kind of change states, become more resistive, and it can slow down the rate at which that power is dissipated through that short. By doing that, you can decrease the ramp of the temperature and allow the cell to come back down to a better state and kind of dissipate that power over a longer period of time. And we have a great video on our website if your listeners would like to go check it out.
Fantastic. Now, you guys also have a laser technology program. So, James, you got to talk to me more about that.
Absolutely. We love lasers. So one of the things we recognized very early in the process was, in order to make a battery like we do, we're going to have to cut more electrodes. And so we spent a lot of time developing ways of cutting and stacking electrodes that are much more efficient than what are used in the state-of-the-art sense systems today. And, you know, traditional electrodes are cut mainly by kind of mechanical punching or cutting processes. And they're great, except for the fact that, you know, we can do a lot of electrodes run into problems. For one is every single design needs a set of hardware, right? There's every new battery design is a new set of hardware. You got to switch it out. You got to store it. You got to figure it out. And then over time, these mechanical cutting systems, they wear down. They just kind of get dull. You know, they have to be replaced. And so if you're cutting a lot more electrodes, that becomes a bigger issue. So very early on, we recognized that if we could do our electro cutting and patterning with lasers, we could be much more agile in our manufacturing. Now, in order to change battery, you know, designs, we can do it very quickly. You know, lasers can be changed largely by software with minimal hardware changes, which is great. We can be much more agile, much more high volume in that regard. The other thing is lasers generally don't wear out, right? You don't have to worry about blades getting dull and things like that. They're predictable, they're measurable, you can get instant feedback. And so those are really kind of key drivers that we really see as lasers can offer us. Like I said before, we look at lasers being super strategic for us just because of the way we make our batteries and the way we think batteries should be made in the future. And we've been very proactive with some of the leading laser companies in the world. And I think last November, we announced a kind of a strategic partnership with IPG Photonics Corporation. It's kind of a world leader in the high power fiber laser technologies. And we're really working with them to, you know, understand to optimize the system for the battery world and to look at how we can use lasers more broadly in the manufacturing process. Already, we've seen huge increases in our own internal manufacturing in terms of throughput and optimization. But we really believe that, you know, leveraging everything that's going on in the laser world right now, all the learning they've had in similar fields, optimizing it for the battery field to get really good high throughput, clean cuts. We're really excited that we can get multiple orders of improvement in terms of high volume production in our systems.
That's fantastic. So where are you guys headed from here?
Today, we're highly focused on getting to market right now. We are focused on ramping our production here at our Fremont facility. This is our line one. And this battery is really focused on, like I said, the consumer space right now. We recently, as of last week, announced that we had just put the POs in for our Gen 2 manufacturing equipment, which is really exciting. That'll be a really big step in throughput and capability over what we have today. Then we announced that we're going to be putting those into Malaysia, into Penang, actually, later this year. So we're really excited about that. In general, my team's really trying to ramp up on the EVs. So we're really excited where that can go and really see how we can unlock this battery potential and Enovix architecture potential into the market in the near future.
Fantastic. All right, James, it's time for your off-the-cuff question now. Since you haven't been on my show before, you get the standard off-the-cuff. So, James, if you could have one meal right now, it doesn't matter if it's on the other side of the world, the restaurant is closed, you need a passport to get there, what would you have?
Oh, that's a great question. Just so you know, I'm really boring, and I would take Thanksgiving dinner at home any day. That's where I would be.
That is lovely. James, I've been asking this question for a couple years now, and that's the first time that has been answered. Oh, that's really sweet. Well, James, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Amelia. It's been a pleasure.
Did I say a transistor made of wood? In fact, I did. So get this. A team of researchers from Linköping University and the KTH Royal Institute of Technology in Sweden have developed the world's first functional wooden transistor. Okay, so this is how they did it. First, they chose a wood that's known for its grainless, even structure. And that wood was balsa wood. First, they got rid of the lignin in the wood, which are the rigid polymers that give wood its strength. After they removed these polymers, what was left was long cellulose fibers that contained hollow channels. Those channels were then filled with a conductive polymer called PDOT-PSS. From there, they created a wooden transistor that works just like any old regular transistor. It could switch power on and off, regulate an electric current passing through it, and provide a consistent flow of electrons at a selected output level. but maybe not the best transistor ever made, because this preliminary design did take about 5 seconds to turn on and about a second to switch off. Isaac Enquist, corresponding author of this study, says this about these new wooden transistors. He says, "Yes, the wooden transistor is slow and bulky, but it does work and has a huge development potential. We didn't create the wooden transistor with any specific application in mind. We did it because we could. This is basic research showing that it's possible, and we hope it will inspire further research that can lead to applications in the future." Okay, so what kind of applications could there be for these new wooden transistors? Well, a lot, actually. There are a couple key advantages here. First, the large conductive channels could help it handle a higher current than other organic transistors. Second, since it is biodegradable, this could be a great way to reduce e-waste. And this team also points out that they could be integrated into electronic circuits in living plants, which was also a project in development at the Linköping University Laboratory for Organic Electronics. So no, wooden transistors are not ready for prime time right now. But with this new idea planted, imagine where it could grow from here. And if you'd like even more information about this new study, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com and in the description for this week's episode on YouTube as well. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you would like to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, I dig it. You can follow us or me on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by me. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can subscribe to this here podcast through Spotify, Podbean, or Apple Podcasts. And remember, if you'd like to further support this podcast, please leave me a review on that podcasting platform of your choice. It really does help. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology or heck you just want to chat, shoot me a line at Amelia, that's AMELIA, at eejournal.com, or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of May 5th, 2023, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.